Welcome to the program. My guest today is Spring Washam. She's a visionary meditation and Dharma teacher based in California and South America. She's a founding teacher of the East Bay Meditation Center and a member of the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. She's a founder of Lotus Vine Journeys, blending indigenous healing practices with Buddhist wisdom. She's also a healer, facilitator, spiritual activist, and writer, leading workshops, classes, and retreats worldwide. She's here today to talk about her book, A Fierce Heart, Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment. I'm Richard Brendan, and you're listening to Journeys Fire. Spring Washam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of my friends have seen this book under my arm, and they all love the title, A Fierce Heart, because clearly, given everything that's going on, not only in the world, but in our country, it's taking a fierce heart to sustain ourselves through all that.
It is. It's true. I mean, it's gone to new levels, let's say.
Yeah.
Internally and externally, I agree.
Well, you're a great person to write this book because in your past, you're biracial, you grew up outside of Compton. You had a lot of issues going on. You were dealing with wounds of racism, personal abandonment. How did you come to your practice and weaving this and also turning to Buddhism?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in one way, the stories of all of our lives and our difficulties, in some ways they become the magic about what leads us on the path. So many people start off in all these difficult situations, but yeah. As I was growing up, I just was really thoughtful and always looking around at what was happening around me. And I was very curious about the suffering of the adults in my life and my family in the streets where I saw people in our apartment building.
Yeah.
And so as I got to be a teenager, I got really interested in psychology because I knew that it was something with my mind. Mm-hmm. And with other people's mind.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, it's something the way we're thinking that's leading to this. And that led me more and more into looking at meditation as a way to understand my mind. And as I got older, I started studying Paramahansa Yogananda's work, the author of Autobiography of a Yogi.
Yes.
And Self-Realization Fellowship. I know a lot of people have run across that book at mm-hmm. one point in their life or another.
Mm-hmm.
But really it was just wanting to understand the suffering in my mind. So it led me to starting to practice meditation. And then when I was in my early 20s, I ended up going on a meditation retreat and I didn't know who was leading it. All I was told was it's 10 days in the desert and it's vegetarian food and they'll teach you how to meditate. And I had been practicing on my own, and I didn't feel like I was making progress.
Mm.
You know, we don't have, this was where before all the apps and YouTube, and, you know, you're just kind of on your own to figure out your mind. So it was there that I met my first teacher, Jack Kornfield, mm. and then I really, really liked the Buddhist psychology and mm-hmm. the map of consciousness mm-hmm. and the path of meditation that they offered.
Yeah, yeah. How old were you when you maybe experienced for the first time racism and in feelings of loneliness, abandonment? Were you a young child, a teenager?
Yeah, I think it was after we had left. We moved out of L.A. and we moved to Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my mother, she lied to get me and my sister into a different school district.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We were living in one district, but to go to this one school, you had to live in that area. And that was like a very upscale school district, really fancy. We were the only children of color.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that I started to experience it, but by teachers and by not the students, but the parents of the students.
Mm.
They would tell me that my friends would say, oh, my mom doesn't want you to come over. I don't know what's wrong with her. And I didn't really think about it till a lot later.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, wow, yeah, we really did have a hard time, you know, with the parents and some of the teachers at the school. So.
Yeah. Having talked to others, I mean, none of them are authors, they're just friends of mine who grew up in similar circumstances. I guess my question to you, and we'll get into the book here, is before you then made that turn to Buddhist practices, you could have turned a whole nother direction growing up in that kind of environment. What do you think it was within you that caused you to go down the path you did and not another one of self-destruction?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. And I work with young people sometimes, and I get asked that question, like, how do you avoid? And you know, I had some dark years, but they were when I was really young, and I was able to kind of be resilient. I think it's just, you know, my human nature. I was very interested. I was very compassionate. And I was very thoughtful. I would say there was a kind of mindfulness that I had where I was always looking at what causes what. Why is this situation happening to me? Why is this, you know, and I was always looking to the roots of things. And I was just very interested. I was I was an incredible reader. I read everything I could get my hands on as a young person. I'd go to libraries, I'd read every book on psychology, whatever was there. I just consumed it. I was so interested in understanding. So who knows? Yeah, you know, you just you're born into a situation and you use those circumstances in your favor.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. You recount the story of your first retreat in which you were the only person of color, and not only that, but the youngest by three decades. How did that shape your understanding of Buddhist practice and your particular place in the world of contemporary Buddhism?
I, you know, that was really what surprised me when I went on my first retreat. I think I thought it was going to be a lot of hippies. You know, you read things or you look at stuff online, and then it was all these kind of upper middle class suburbanites. And I was like, what? What's going on here? But at the time, honestly, I sort of was able to compartmentalize that because I was in such a desperate situation on my own level, just my emotions, my mind, just my own inner turmoil, that I was just really able to stay in my own lane and focus on the instructions, what was happening, pay attention, and in a way that allowed me to fall in love with the teaching first and foremost.
Yeah.
Like, wow, this really is a good medicine for me. I really like how I'm understanding my mind. I'm really liking how to learn how to be in the present moment. So it was years later that those experiences led me to wanting to start a community in Oakland. So out of that longing for community, we started the East Bay Meditation Center in downtown Oakland. That was kind of an expression of wanting to be in an environment of community that looked like I did, you know, that looked like my family, and, you know, and just something that was much more global, you know, like, oh, how do we welcome all beings?
Yes. You know?
And so that, so those experiences really, you know, after practicing many years in those conditions and feeling, starting to feel the suffering of that, you know, language and culture have a way of creating inclusion and exclusion. Just by how someone says something, the examples they use, the reference that they have, is very based on their life experience. And if it doesn't sort of mirror somebody else's, you kind of start to feel the loneliness in that, the suffering of, wow. So that, again, I just use that as a way to say, what if I was to create a community? And I needed to create that community. Otherwise, I think my faith would have fallen, right? I don't know if I could have stayed on the path.
Absolutely, because we all need that support, don't we?
Yeah, like sometimes a woman needs to go to a woman's class and men need to be with men. And, you know, and there's certain things that you need to be sort of mirrored at certain moments.
Yes.
And it's not to negate that we're all one. We are, but it's a relative level.
Right.
You know, our human level that somehow we're healing.
Right. And Ram Dass says that we're all just walking each other home.
Yeah.
I'm always fascinated. That's why I asked you about how through circumstances oftentimes and challenges that our destiny has a way of finding us. And clearly that's what happened to you and really why you're doing what you're doing now. I want to hone in on the title. I do love that title. What for you?
Thank you.
What for you, Spring, is a fierce heart?
Yeah, for me, when I think of those with fierce hearts, I think of those that, as we were sharing about, that allow difficulties to be an important part of their path. They use the suffering in their life as a way to wake up, to grow, to serve others. And so what happened was when I was in Oakland, I was seeing so many people doing that. I was hearing all these stories of redemption and forgiveness. And I was like, wow, everybody here is so, their hearts are so fierce because we could keep going. We get up another day and we keep on singing. We keep on, you know, it's that quality of the human spirit. And it sort of speaks to our wider culture. I mean, don't we love the underdog stories?
Absolutely.
Don't
yes.
we love the hero who's been through everything and they keep rising out of the, you know, the Phoenix and like Nelson Mandela and Dr. King and all these people that we come to admire as archetypal figures, but they also reflect our own capacity.
Yeah.
And so a fierce heart is that. You know, what is that quality? It's like Maya Angelou and the Buddha and, you know, even beyond figures throughout time who kind of withstood all of the things that come at somebody, you know, that could railroad them off their path. But they use it to keep being more loving, to yeah. keep opening, to keep shining. It's that I was pointing to.
Well, and it's needed because we are living through a great time of really great political and social division. More and more shootings across our country. We've impeached a president. It seems like Washington is more broken now than ever. How can cultivating a fierce heart help us to confront this vast political challenges that we face?
Yeah, when I look back, it's astonishing to me the last few years. Astonishing on some level. Like, wow, it's another civil rights movement. I never, you know, it's like, wow, well, what if I use it as I get to live through this?
Yeah.
Instead of looking in the 60s and the 50s and the, you know, it's like, wow, we're living in another, you know, era. And I know a lot of people lived through, you know, the 60s and all of these different movements. But I think it's important to, if we're following a spiritual path, I think it's important to just find our faith right now.
Yeah.
And for people who are feeling lost because of all of this volatility and anger and separation, to commit to some kind of spiritual practice to help navigate through it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what we rely on now. Mm-hmm. What else is there? It's so unstable.
That's so true. That is so
yes.
true.
Yes, it's so unstable. We have no idea what's going to happen in 1 month, 6 months, a year. It's all, you know, we can show up, but use the circumstances. And there's some way that we can observe this process to understand, like, wow, look at what happens when these energies come out, and what we can observe the process and still stay with our goodness.
Mm.
You know, we commit to our own ethics. This has made me pull more into my path, not less.
I like how you say we should reframe it. In other words, I get to live through this. Some would even say this is an auspicious time to be living.
Yeah. I do believe that because sometimes intensity is growth.
Mm.
And if we were all just like checked out and, you know, everything was okay, we go to sleep. But right now we're not asleep. We're like, ah, you know, there's fire around
yes.
us. Like it's a sort of pointing out like, no, it's not the time to just check out here. You know, if you have a heart, it's going to be engaged, you know, and so there is something about that I think makes for perfect conditions for growth and evolution and awakening more of the heart factor.
I so agree. I think we do need that rising of a fierce heart in as many people as possible, because I remember something Andrew Harvey once said, the alternative is we end up in a coca coma. We're just numbing ourselves with TV and alcohol and to try to get away from it. So I love what you are about and what this book is about. It's encouraging people to rise up and to open up their hearts and to be that warrior, if you will. I also know one of the tools that's going to be very important to do that, and I think it's challenging. Clearly, it's challenging for people because it doesn't happen very often, and that's forgiveness. And so I want to ask you for you and from your perspective, why is forgiveness so important and so needed today?
Yeah, and you know, I write about it. I think one of the most powerful chapters, one of them in the book, is about forgiveness, and I call it Free Your Heart. I think it's just about letting go of the bitterness, you know, and letting go of resentment. You know, so much time is spent, even right now, stewing in rage and hatred. You know, anger is not a problem. Anger is an experience that we all, you know, it comes out, you know, in the traffic jam or in the morning, or we wake up with it or we get triggered by it. But hatred is really a choice. Right. And hatred is like feeding that fire. And I've seen people do it from all sides of the spectrum, all nationalities, all colors. Right? We can kind of feed this negativity because we're angry and we haven't really forgiven those who have done things, or we perceive that they've done things or even real traumatic things, you know. So I think that this forgiveness is just a kind of opening to our shared humanity. We've all experienced everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard to get through a human life without experiencing a little bit of everything. Even if you're a gazillionaire, you know, it's like it doesn't protect you fully. You still, you know, not fully, you know, because it's human experience. You know, you can't buy your way out of it unless you're on a, you know, desert island somewhere, and maybe then you could for a little bit.
Yeah.
But everything's happening to everybody.
Yes, it is. You know? It is.
And so there's a awakening into that leads to a kind of forgiveness.
Have you ever seen a movie, Love Actually, with Hugh Grant?
I think I have. That sounds so familiar.
It's interwoven stories about love set during a time of Christmas in England. The reason I bring that up, I was thinking about this interview, and I just wanted to read this to you, but I just saw it on TV a couple nights ago, and there's a quote. It's a quote in the movie, and it's by Hugh Grant, who plays the British Prime Minister in a film, and here's what he says. Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, I think about the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport. General opinions starting to make out that we live in a world of hatred and greed, but I don't see that. It seems to me that love is everywhere. Often it's not particularly dignified or newsworthy, but it's always there. Fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, husbands and wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, old friends. When the planes hit the Twin Towers, as far as I know, none of the phone calls from the people on board were messages of hate or revenge. They were all messages of love. If that you look at that, I've got a sneaky feeling you'll find that love actually is all around. And in the work that you do as a meditation teacher and Dharma teacher, you're really helping people to do that, aren't you? To shift their perception of what they're seeing.
Yeah, and to feel into it. So not so much in the mind, but in the heart. You know, the heart is in the body. And we're a very mind-forward culture. This is something I've learned a lot about, you know, living in half a year in South America and half a year here, is that, you know, we're learning how to, through meditation and other healing arts, live more in our body, which is more where the juice is.
Yeah.
You know, when we're just in our stories, we're neurotic, you know. Our minds are crazy, but my heart is strong. I don't rely on my mind. I bring issues down into my heart, and I say, okay, heart, we got to hold this. Here we go. We can do it. And my heart can do it. My mind, it just goes to pieces, right? Like all of our minds do, you know. But we can discover something deeper in our capacity to feel and to grow. But we have to be willing to feel, you know, and break out of this kind of numbness that affects a lot of us.
So we're to get out of our head and into our heart. I love
yeah,
that.
What did someone say? They say it's the longest journey you'll ever take from the head to the heart. I believe that.
Yeah.
I'm on that journey.
Oh, yeah. Me too. In your book, A Fierce Heart, you share the story of meditating with a group of people while a riot was going on outside in the wake of the Trump victory. What does that story tell us about the power of meditation and community?
Yeah, that still is a memory I won't forget, because I was 2 days after the election. He was elected on a Tuesday, and then I was there on a Thursday. And so and it was really interesting because I was scheduled, and now we have our meditation center right in downtown Oakland, California. Oakland is always a hot spot of activism, social justice. You name it, it happens in the Bay Area and, you know, Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco. It's just a place of a lot of movement and a lot of thoughtful culture and standing up for things. So I'm there at our center, and I go to teach the meditation class, and there's like a few hundred people in our center, which usually only fits about 100. And everyone was squeezed in. And it was a people of color evening. It was designed. It was, you know, for years, our Thursday night. And so there I see all these people of every nationality, Latin, I see African American, I see Middle Eastern, I see all these faces. And while we were doing the meditation, while I was trying to lead it, and it was so hot. I remember this intense heat. So the windows had gotten opened at one point, and all this tear gas started coming in, and then we could hear the police screaming on the megaphones, "Stop, stop!" And we could hear helicopters, "Put down your," you know, and there was, come to find out, there was like 15,000 people rioting up and down downtown Oakland.
Wow.
And so I just remember, I just held on to what was true in that moment. Like, you know, this is a story, but one chapter in a vast story. You know, this isn't, you know, we will live through this moment just like our ancestors have.
Yeah.
And watch the mind that creates more fear and terror, you know. And we spoke to about love and a fierce heart that night, and being present and remembering our values. And I don't even remember all of what I said. I wish I would have recorded it, but I think it was enough to be like a balm, you know, to help the sadness and the fear and the frustration that people were feeling that were gathered at that particular place. I know other people were celebrating, so there you go. That was an interesting phenomenon. Some people, that was the best night of their life. Other people, you know, it's different.
The principles you lay out in this book are so very practical, because I can't think of anything that can be also more painful for someone. And that's maybe the loss of a loved one, whether it be through death or a breakup of some sorts. And one of your most profound breakthroughs came after the love of your life left you for another woman. Can you tell us that story and explain how it illustrates your point that we can grow through the most from suffering?
Yes, and I write about that chapter in a chapter called The White Condor, which was about a shamanic period of my life. And yes, I think it's been in a series of just 3 weeks. The man that I just wanted to marry beyond anyone else flew across. He was in Australia, came back to see me, and then tells me I'm in love with someone else. And yeah, it was just, I don't think I ever loved someone like that before. I'm not someone who falls in love easily, so I just didn't expect that.
Yeah.
Then shortly after that, I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you need to have your uterus taken out.
Whoa.
And I was like, oh, it was like a whole bunch of medical things. It came out of nowhere. I mean, this was like a month, everything. I'm going to get married. I love this person. Maybe I have a child. And then it was all gone. And I remember really going through a dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
That's what it sent me into. And I was used to suffering. That wasn't it. I thought I was, you know, equipped to deal with it, but it was just another level of letting go and experiencing the grief. So I write about that chapter, and I go on this retreat, and I was fasting and meditating and up in this beautiful forest And I just allowed all of the grief to just let go. And I had a series of mystical experiences and dreams. And I just wrote that chapter to be really real about my process, because so many people have these dark night of the soul moments.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more about what a dark night of the soul is? Sometimes our listeners will hear that phrase from various people. But when you go through that, it really is dark.
It's dark. It feels like you've been abandoned out of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So usually how you know that happens is your practices or your religious connection, either, you know, maybe it's Jesus or God, Mother Mary, Buddha, whatever, Muhammad, whatever you relate to, you feel as if there's no connection anymore. And usually it coincides with life also falling apart. So marriage is ending, jobs ending, medical diagnosis, usually it's something that sort of shatters your identity and your clinging,
mm-hmm.
right? Usually all these things happen at the same time. However, it can be also a slow buildup.
Mm-hmm.
It can be through addiction. It could happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people say they go through a dark night with, you know, heroin, drugs, alcohol, sex addiction, that also can bring on this kind of thing. But the great thing about the dark night is it undermines your faith, because you feel like you'll never get out of it, it'll never change. But the beautiful thing is I realized that those are almost like a birth canal on some level. Like you go through this darkness and the struggle and you don't see where it's going to end. And then at some point, it does lead usually for people to a life transforming experience. They usually change.
Mm-hmm.
They become a healthier person.
Mm-hmm.
They move into a spiritual community. They change everything about maybe their appearance or the kind of job they were drawn to, or there's some shift psychologically or emotionally and mentally that usually is a breakthrough. And at the end of it, if they survive it, they're usually a much better person for it.
Well, clearly, I think opening to difficult emotions and accepting traumatic experiences, it's frightening for a whole lot of people. What do you say to folks who feel just too scared to try to fully integrate these things?
I think that that's probably our biggest challenge in the Western culture, is a fear of feeling.
Ah.
Like, we are terrified to feel anything unpleasant, right? We're like, oh, you got an emotion? Let's stuff it down.
Yeah.
Let's medicate it. Let's get rid of it. Don't feel that sadness. Don't feel that fear.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel that unhappiness. And I think in some way it stunts our growth.
Mm.
You know, we don't know how to be emotionally intelligent yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the more that we're able to open and trust that the emotions are not going to be forever. We believe that if we feel this bad feeling, we'll be in bed eating Oreos for 10 years, right? We forget that it's temporary. So learning how to be with emotions as energy is really a skill.
Yeah.
It's a skill to feel and to experience it and then to let it go.
Well, and that's really all about just being present with all of it, isn't it?
Yeah, being present. Mm-hmm.
With the joy, with the sorrow, with the tears, with the laughter, all of it.
Yeah, and I think that's what people learn to do on meditation retreats, because, you know, they sign up for a 5-day silent retreat. There's nowhere to go. It's just the present moment. They're kind of forced into being with feelings that they might have been stuffing down and not dealing with. So that's what makes meditation sometimes beautiful, but sometimes hard.
Yes.
You know, we're reconciling ourselves, our tangles. It's not just this, you know, we see images of people blissed out. You know, we're like, yeah, give me that. But that, honestly, after years of teaching, that is not how people look on the beginnings of meditation retreats. And even maybe the last day, but mostly they're walking around in old sweatpants with tear streaks on their face and Kleenex in their pocket.
Yeah.
They're being with, you know, the range of the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows.
Yeah. I remember the season finale, those who are listening and watched the show Mad Men, at the very end, Don Draper, one of the lead characters who had a lot of stuff going on in his life, they show him at the very end sitting on the cliff at Esalen, I know it's Esalen, but they didn't say it was Esalen in the TV episode, in kind of a lotus position, looking out at the ocean. And all I could think about was, yeah, right now he's feeling that way. But when the struggles of life hit, we don't know what happens to him weeks down the road if he's not doing his work.
Right. And we don't know what it was like, you know, a few days before or usually, you know, that's like after the cycle of what you go through.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what we're talking about, is that why you say the present moment is medicine for the mind?
Yeah, because in some way the present moment is honest. Mm-hmm. You know, it is what it is, whether it's happy, sad, joy, fear, craving. You know, and it's like just learning how to meet those moments and let go of them. A really important strength builds in the mind when people learn how to be present with beautiful moments and difficult moments. Yeah. A spiritual maturity evolves through that just by resting in the present moment more and more, you know, and we're learning how to do it. It's a practice.
I want to circle around about something that you brought up early in our conversation, and that's East Bay Meditation Center that you founded. Can you tell us more about that and its mission?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we founded the East Bay Meditation Center out of a dream to make the teachings of the Dharma, mm-hmm. Buddhism, psychology, the heart practices more accessible. So kind of off the mountain of Esalen into the streets, you know,
like,
okay, not everybody's like going to go there, but there's a lot of people in downtown Oakland, though, that, you know, will walk to the center and come to the center. So that was our premise. How do we build a community and make the teachings as accessible as possible, almost like a mental health and heart practice for everyone, right?
Yeah.
And so we did. We ended up opening up after a few years of planning and struggling and, you know, all the growth pains of a startup, you know. We did open a beautiful space in downtown Oakland, and we used the model of generosity-based economics, meaning everything was offered on donation. We didn't want anything to block access. Hmm. So anybody could come in and sit down, and they could learn the practices. And we started teaching all the mindfulness, you know, a lot of Buddha Dharma stuff for activists, healthcare workers, communities of color, LGBTQ, transgender communities, youth, Spanish speaking. It was like our practice was to be available and to be in service to all beings everywhere. That was sort of our bodhisattva heart prayer.
Oh.
And it was really immediately extremely successful. We had way more people than we could ever imagine, and we moved into a bigger facility just a couple blocks away. So we were right off the main access for people to walk there and get, you know, the bus stops. Everything was, you know, ride bikes. We had bike facilities. So we were really trying to create something that was very inclusive. So we were very skillful with who we had teaching there because we wanted the teachings to come through in a way that would be translated into the experience of that community. Like, how can I make a Dharma talk accessible for a single mom in East Oakland with four kids?
Yeah.
You know, how is the Dharma relevant?
Yes,
because it's timeless wisdom. She knows what suffering is. She lives it. You know, it's not hard to get people to understand. It's wisdom is like, yes, I know what you're saying here. So it was about translating things. So it didn't become this practice for the elite. Mm-hmm. It became the practice for all beings.
Mm.
And so I just had so much joy teaching there, practicing there, and learning how to hone in on how to serve, you know, and how to reach communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even have to try to reach them. I let them just reach me and have it open my heart. Each person there touched me so deeply. And the book is really, I dedicate the book to that community, and it helped me grow in all the ways that I feel like my heart has evolved is through all the beautiful moments that I've had there over the last 14 years.
That is so awesome. The first chapter in your book is called Blooming in the Mud. Now, for all the non-Buddhists out there, what does that mean? And what's the significance in relation to the path you took?
Well, the lotus flower, we always have that archetypal flower, is the national flower of India. And it means awakening. So it's used a lot in centers and yoga places and blooming. And what's so great about the lotus flower is it can bloom for 1,000 years. And it can bloom in the muddiest of waters, right? So its roots are sunk all the way down in this kind of mud. And then it shoots up these beautiful, you know, out of the mud and the muck. Here you have this amazing flower. And so that's really what that first chapter is about. Like wherever your roots have been, wherever you come from, whoever you are, and I would teach that a lot at our center in Oakland, that if you come from this walk of life or you come here, whatever your experiences are, now is the place to begin. Mm. And it's perfect.
Yeah.
You don't need to be, you know, someone other than you to practice. You need what you are is great, and it doesn't matter if it's in the mud. Let it bloom in the mud like so many others have, you know. The long lineage.
Yes, we're perfect in our imperfections.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I love that. I love that so much. You're also the founder of Lotus Vine Journeys. Can you share more information about that and also about the kind of retreats that you lead across the world?
Yes. Yeah, so Lotus Vine Journeys is something that comes out of, and it's a little, for some people, it might seem a little more wild, or it's definitely had moments of controversy, I would say.
Okay.
Because I work in the jungle. I spend about half the year, and because I've evolved over the years to become almost more in the healing arts and studying Reiki and energy and trauma, really this organization came out of my own work around healing trauma and working with plant-based medicine. So our retreats in Peru are basically 14-day retreats involving meditation, yoga, mostly raw food, vegan diet, and plant-based medicine and shaman.
Okay.
So I have a whole team there, and we take people through a whole journey working with ayahuasca, which is a vine that grows in the jungle. So that's sort of like a whole shamanic side of my life that opened up because I started working with that plant due to trauma. And I, you know, and I wasn't resolving it. I was resolving it on the mental level, but it was still in my body. And so I was introduced to it many years ago by a clinical psychologist. And I found that it had huge, beautiful impact on my healing journey. And I wanted to start creating, I wanted to create a safe environment for others who were stuck, maybe had these great lives, but were still stuck from abuse and trauma and other things as a way that they could move forward in an accelerated way and work with plants and plant consciousness. And I'm sure if people are in the news, they're hearing a lot about this lately. It's like a whole resurgence of doctors and coming out about it and writing about it, and I'm working on a new manuscript about it too.
Absolutely, and I have a personal interest in that area as well, so you never know. I might find myself in Peru at one of the retreats.
Oh, you should come. We have so many beautiful teachers who come. It's really set up for teachers, scholars, people who are all spiritual. It's a niche market. We're not a mass market. We're a niche hotel market, I say, of just working with. But we would love that because it's, we could talk for offline too.
This book, A Fierce Heart, I'm told, is this your first book?
This is my first book.
Wow.
And I'm working on, my second book.
Okay. Can you share what that's going to be about?
My second book is going to be about the shamanic journey and the healing and the planetary consciousness and Buddhism and how merging the shamanic path with ancient wisdom. And so, it's, you know, sort of like a broader book on that whole world and healing and energy and all the things that I've been working on for years that I haven't had a chance to write about. So I'm very excited to get all of these stories and also just, a bit like a, I have many stories. I should have be compiling them all. I could do like data analysis on all of the beauty that I've seen and the healing journeys of many clients.
Oh, I imagine.
So, so I want to share some of those stories in my time living in the jungle, I spent a year living in the upper Amazon with a Shipibo community for a year. Hmm. And I want to share some of that. That's the magic of that as well.
Well, I have been blessed and inspired by this first book, A Fierce Heart, Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment. And certainly I'm looking forward now when your next book comes out. You also have a personal website for people to learn more about you and the work that you're doing. Can you share the web address, please?
Yeah, so they can find me at springwashum.com, and you can find me. I have a YouTube channel, and I try to put out beautiful, inspiring messages on social media, so you can find me on Facebook, too, and I'm always trying to just inspire with good teaching, so you can find me there.
And we need more of that in today's world. Spring Washam, it's indeed an honor and a joy to have you on the program today. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. It's been beautiful.
Once again, if you'd like more information about the work that Spring is doing around the world, I encourage you to visit her online, and that is SpringWashum, WASHAM.com, SpringWashum.com. And that's it for us today. I'm so glad you joined me. I want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.